Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Idan Dershowitz, Department Chair of Bible and Exegesis at Potsdam University, and author of two fascinating new books on the development of the Torah and Bible, including A Dramatic Tale of Scholarly Sabotage, Suicide, and Secret Texts. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. I've been exploring the question of prayer in today's Jewish world for an article in a book that'll be published later this year. At a time when prayer among many Jews seems to have drifted away from our regular practice, it's interesting to explore just how Reform, Conservative, and other non-Orthodox Jews pray now, how they, we, choose to address God in text and tune or not, and what prayer today really means. There's a certain oddity and irony in the fact that many Jews use meditation apps on their phones or practice some form of mindfulness, yet don't actually pray in a synagogue with any regularity, or perhaps at all. Orthodox Jews do tend to pray regularly, especially true of the ultra-Orthodox. That is clearly not the case with all or even most non-Orthodox Jews. That doesn't mean that most of us lack spirituality, or that we don't need to find some way to connect with God in a meaningful way. It's just that we very likely seek it in ways other than prayer, or at least other than in Jewish prayer services. So, just what has replaced prayer as a form of spiritual expression? For some of us, it's the elevated personal experience of listening to music, particularly live music. Whether our preference is for hearing a great symphonic work or an opera, or attending a rock concert or country music or jazz show performed by our favorites. For others, it's designating some period for physical activity, working out, running, biking, hiking, swimming, using that time to replenish our spirits by generating endorphins in our brains. Still others find spiritual connection to their Creator through the mindfulness apps, spiritual podcasts, or a religious meditation. I wonder often about these efforts to seek spiritual connection in various ways. Look, anything that helps people find balance and contentment in their lives that is neither abusive nor negatively addictive is a good thing. But I would suggest that an effort to experience regular Jewish prayer can be of great value to anyone, whether you think of yourself as a religious person, quote-unquote, or not. The simple act of attending a synagogue in community. You can do that in person now at my own congregation Beit Simcha or virtually on Facebook. And reading and listening to the themes of the service, singing along with the music, hearing others interpret the tradition, all can have profound value. It's not that there aren't other ways to expand your spirit or feel God's presence. It's just that this is a very good way to find holiness and connect with a spirit that goes beyond the mundane realities of daily life, and to do so in community. As the rabbi and cantor of a congregation, I am well aware that not every musical setting will connect with each congregant attendee, nor will every word of every sermon touch the heart of each listener. But the very act of choosing to attend a service and pray, or even to try to pray, connects that Jew with his or her people in a unique and truly sacred way, a way that no app nor even any solitary form of meditation can really replace. To play us in this morning, here's a beautiful Echad Odi from the Welcoming of the Sabbath section of the Friday night service, a warm invitation to Jewish prayer.
Bo'i v'shalom, ateret ba'alat, kam v'simcha u'v'tzolat, toch emuneh am segula, bo'i chala, bo'i chala.
That was the conclusion of Josh Warshawski's Lechad Odi for Friday night services, coming this week to a synagogue near you, or at least to ours, Congregation Beit Simcha, right here in Tucson, Arizona. When we return on To Jewish in a moment, our guest, Professor Idan Dershowitz, explains just what the text of Torah and Bible really are, how they were potentially constructed. And then he begins a tale of drama, tragedy, scholarly sabotage, and the possible revelation of an original form of a book of the Bible in scroll form that was rejected, but maybe shouldn't have been. All that when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall. In our own building, not in the mall, services, classes, and events are open to everyone once again. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. Email me to rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHA tucson.org. Or you can join us every Friday night or Saturday morning on our Facebook page for Shabbat celebration services, Fridays at 6:30 p.m., Saturdays at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. We will continue to hold our services with full music, both in person and by virtual experience. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are now live and on Zoom. You can access those by emailing rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended formats as well. Come try it out and sign up for August when we resume. We now have students live and some on Zoom. In fact, for more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services live and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing synagogue and newest Jewish community in all of southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Idan Dershowitz is the head of Bible and exegesis of Bible at Potsdam University, formerly a Harvard University fellow, author of a very interesting new book, and an expert on Bible. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
So I'm going to ask a really basic question. What do you think the Torah is? What do you think the Bible is?
Okay, so I would usually draw a distinction between the Torah and the Bible, although sometimes they're used interchangeably. The Torah is the five books of Moses, so Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And the Bible includes the section of the Nevi'im, or prophets, and the Ketubim, or writing. And we also sometimes use the term Torah, especially in Jewish tradition, to refer more broadly to Jewish teaching and so on. But my main area of expertise is the Hebrew Bible, so the texts of the written texts of the Bible, as opposed to rabbinical works of halakha and midrash and so on.
Well, sure. So now I'm going to dig a little deeper. There are people that think the Torah was given to Moses at Sinai. There are Jews who believe it's a collection of various forms of literature. There are literary analysts who say it doesn't really matter. We're looking at the overall construction. What perspective do you view the Torah from, in particular in light of some of the work you've done recently?
That's a great question. So I guess the issues of who wrote the various books of the Bible, and especially the Torah, and when and so on, whether it was all given at Mount Sinai, these are questions that have various different answers within Jewish tradition, although more recently in Orthodox Jewish tradition, the range of acceptable answers has narrowed somewhat. But throughout traditional history, Jewish intellectual history, there have been ideas that parts of the Bible, indeed parts of the Torah, were written as late as the time of the men of the Great Assembly, in other words, towards the end of the
Anshei Knesset Hagdola, like the 3rd century BCE, something like that.
Right, and these ideas appear in the ancient works of Midrash and in the medieval commentaries and so on. And so the idea that the entire Pentateuch was given to Moses as is on Mount Sinai is certainly not a view that has been universally held within Jewish tradition.
We will talk much more with Idan Dershowitz, including his explication of a fascinating different version of Deuteronomy when we come back here on Two Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, 2JewishRadio.com, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So you made a mistake last week. I know this is hard for our listeners to believe.
Well, I was incomplete. So in that sense, it was a sin of omission. But yeah, I just learned this week through a very fortuitous meeting that, in fact, countries like Iran and Syria, both of which had large, thriving Jewish communities since the destruction of the First Temple, really. The point that I made last week rather emphatically was they're not Sephardic, because they're most Jews there...
What we call Oriental Jews, right. Edot HaMizrach, it's not Jews from Spain and Portugal.
Right. But I learned that that was largely true, but not entirely true, because I met somebody whose family name is a very common name for Jews in Thessaloniki and Rhodes, and all of those families came from Spain. But I had never heard it attached to anybody who wasn't from one of those two communities. And I asked this guy if he had any links. He said, no, my father's Persian. My mother is a mix of Syrian and Egyptian, but we are Sephardim. I said, so how is that? Because to the best of my knowledge, most Persian Jews have been there since
2,500 years
ago.
Not
only before Islam, but before Christianity was born.
For sure. First Temple times, right. Destruction of the First Temple, exile to Babylon, Persia takes over. Now there's Jews in Persia.
Right. So this guy explained to me that at the peak of Jewish population in Iran, probably 5 or 10% of the Jews there came from Spain. And it was one of the places they settled after the expulsion, even though it wasn't part of the Ottoman Empire. Now, Egypt and Syria both were. So his mother, who's a member of the Syrian Jewish community in Brooklyn, is truly Sephardic, because they were a Spanish family who settled in a province of the Ottoman Empire, like so many others. The Jews of Thessaloniki, the Jews of Sarajevo, most Jews in Bulgaria, etc., etc. The difference is that most of the places I just mentioned, whether Sarajevo or Plovdiv or whatever, did not have Jewish populations since before the creation of Christianity, or even necessarily before the creation of Islam. The vast majority of their Jewish populations came from the Iberian Peninsula in the years following 1492. So they are truly Sephardic rather than Edot HaMizrach. But I have to footnote what I said last time about the Jewish communities in Iran.
Iran, yeah.
And
Afghanistan,
Syria.
Syria, perhaps.
No, they didn't. They didn't go as far as
Afghanistan,
okay. Because that was too far, and it was considered too removed from civilization for Jews from Spain, who had been very urban and very cultured and very like aristocratic, to go to. But places like Aleppo, Damascus, Cairo, and Tehran, Shiraz, Isfahan, they were considered Ki'ilu Cordoba.
So Cordoba in the East.
Right.
Tom, thanks very much for that clarification. Really interesting. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. There has been a great deal of conspiracy theorizing going around the web lately. Listen, when I was younger, I also blamed Jewish people for all my problems and thought they were part of a conspiracy to control and ruin my life. Turns out they were just being good Jewish parents. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Bamidbar, first in the book of Numbers, given its name by the census that occupies a good part of the start of this Torah portion. Superficially, it's just a listing of names and numbers, not a very interesting text at all for study or inspiration. But it teaches a primary lesson. Every human being counts in God's eyes, and should similarly count in our eyes as well. There's an unusual phrase at the beginning of Bamidbar. The survey is to be taken of the entire nation, b'mispar shemot, by the numbering of names. In other words, even though by definition a census is an accounting, a totaling of sums, every individual is to be accounted for, not by number, but by name. Each person has a unique identity, a human face. Each is an image of God. The notion that every human being counts is part of our tradition in many ways, from the requirement to have 10 Jewish adults for a minyan, to the obligation that we must view every other person as a tzelem Elohim, an image of God no different from ourselves in holiness. The Talmud tells us that one who saves a single life is accorded the merit of having saved the entire world. Each of us is counted because we all count. Paradoxically, even counting itself can be transformed into an affirmation of sanctity. During this period between Pesach and Shavuot, we count each day of the Omer as a kind of special preparation, remembering the connection between freedom and covenant. We count each day so that we can make each day count until, well, the day of Shavuot, when we reach the 50th day. And when we do the tabulation of the 10 people required for a minyan, traditionally we don't count by numbers because that would devalue each human being into a mere digit. Instead, we find a verse from the Bible that has 10 words and work our way through it until we've completed the passage, thus making every member of that accounting part of a holy sentence. In a world of numbers, in an era of ever-increasing analytics, it is comforting to realize that we are each much more than the sum of our parts. No matter how we seek to quantify and digitize our world, each one of us, especially you, matters to God. And that is worth counting and recounting again and again. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Professor Idan Dershowitz, shares with us an incredible tale of the discovery of a potential original version of a book of the Torah, accusations of fraud that doomed the scholar who discovered it, and new information that may prove it is real after all, some 140 years after it was discounted and lost. Hear this remarkable story when we return on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In a major tragedy, 45 people died at a Lag BaOmer festival observance at Mount Meron in northern Israel last week, the deadliest civilian disaster in all of Israeli history. A human stampede broke out on the night of Lag BaOmer. 150 people were hospitalized in addition to the 45 who died. The dead included 6 Americans, 2 Canadians, an Argentine, and a Brit. The disaster occurred at Mount Meron during the celebration of Lag BaOmer, the holiday when tens of thousands of people, mostly ultra-Orthodox Jews, gathered to honor Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, second-century sage and mystic buried at Meron. Large crowds traditionally light bonfires, pray, and dance as part of the celebrations. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called it a great tragedy and said that everyone was praying for the victims. The incident happened after midnight, close to 1 a.m. The cause of the stampede was an attempt by some of the overpacked crowd to exit down a narrow stairway. Somebody slipped on spilled beverages, and then other people slipped, and everybody fell on the men below. Videos on social media show huge numbers of ultra-Orthodox Jews packed together in the very tight spaces there just prior to the disaster. Eli Baer, director of Hatzalah, the Israeli Rescue Ambulance Organization, said he was shocked by the size of the crowd at Lag BaOmer celebrations at Meron. Police estimate that over 100,000 people were packed into a very small area. Baer said there were five times the number of people that should have been allowed to enter the location. A witness said that masses of people were pushed into the same corner and a vortex was created. He said the first row of people fell down, then a second row where he was standing also began to fall from the pressure of the stampede. I felt like I was about to die. Saki Heller, a spokesman for the Magen David Adom Rescue Service, said no one ever dreamed something like this could happen. In one moment, we went from a happy celebration to an immense tragedy. It was the first mass religious gathering in Israel to be held legally since they lifted nearly all restrictions related to the coronavirus pandemic. Israel has seen COVID cases plummet since launching the world's most successful vaccination campaign, late 2020. Israeli health authorities nevertheless warned against holding such a large gathering, but when the celebration started, Public Security Minister Amir Ohana, Police Chief Yaakov Shabtai, and other top officials visited the event, met with police, who had deployed 5,000 extra forces to try to maintain order. It didn't work. Ohana, a close ally of Netanyahu, thanked police beforehand for their hard work and dedication, protecting the well-being and security of the many participants. Not so much. In the blame game that's followed this terrible tragedy, Prime Minister Netanyahu and Benny Gantz are involved in the investigation. The deadly stampede could have been prevented, said State Comptroller Matanyahu Engelman, whose office warned back in 2008 and again in 2011 that Meron in Israel's north could not accommodate mass gatherings. The probe will include aspects pertaining to personal liability, said Engelman. Justice Minister Gantz also said he intends to set up a commission of inquiry to investigate the failures that caused this deadly and tragic stampede. You know, I've been to Mount Meron a number of times, making the pilgrimage to the grave of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the theoretical author of the Zohar, greatest text of Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, that I teach every week. I've been at Meron when it was lightly attended, and it was possible to approach the tomb and offer prayers. But I've also been there during much more minor festivals than Lag BaOmer. And even then, ultra-Orthodox crowding, mostly from young Haredi yeshiva students, felt dangerous. It was, frankly, impossible to get anywhere near the actual memorial. I can't imagine how out of control it must have seemed that night, filled to the brim in the tight courtyards and passageways, as bus after bus of worshippers arrived at the packed site for the great mystical night of Lag BaOmer, energy flowing after a year and more of lockdown. This was a preventable tragedy, and the deaths are just awful. I fully expect Israel will institute serious changes at Mount Meron to make it possible for people to pray and visit without the serious dangers that have existed there for years and came to a tragic disaster last week. In New York, also last week, police arrested a 29-year-old man on hate crime charges in connection with his vandalizing several Bronx synagogues, including destroying prayer books. The NYPD Hate Crimes Task Force arrested Jordan Burnett from the Bronx for refusing to cooperate with officers and provide proper ID after he was stopped riding a bicycle against the flow of traffic. Surveillance footage showed Burnett smashing a van windshield with a rock ahead of his encounter with police. Further investigation connected Burnett to several vandalism incidents at synagogues in the Riverdale area of New York. A caretaker at a Doth Israel of Riverdale told police a bicycle stolen from the synagogue shed matched the one Burnett was riding when he was stopped. He faces charges including burglary as a hate crime and numerous charges related to the acts of vandalism as hate crimes that have taken place in this community, said Jessica Corey, commanding officer of the NYPD Hate Crimes Task Force. Burnett threw rocks at multiple synagogues, breaking many glass windows, damaging other property. Police believe he's responsible for attacking at least four synagogues in Riverdale last month, including the Riverdale Jewish Center, Young Israel of Riverdale, Chabad Lubavitch of Riverdale, and the conservative synagogue Doth Israel. John Miller, NYPD's Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence and Counterterrorism, said officers from his bureau had been guarding synagogues and other houses of worship in the area. "I think this will bring a great sense of relief to the Riverdale community," he said. "Hopefully life can resume back to normal and people will be able to worship without fear." The number of anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. remain near historically high levels, at least they did in 2020. There were more than 2,000 instances of assault, harassment, and vandalism reported across 47 states and D.C., according to the ADL's annual survey, also released last week. Last year marked the third highest year for incidents against American Jews since the ADL began tracking that data way back in 1979. The states with the highest numbers of incidents included New York, New Jersey, California, Florida, and Pennsylvania. The Capitol attack January 6th, of course, showed many rioters wearing clothing with anti-Semitic messages, including the phrase Camp Auschwitz. Jewish leaders say the growth of anti-Semitic crimes intensified under former President Trump's administration. Community leaders praised the arrest of Burnett in this New York story, but they remain concerned about the rise in hate crimes against religious groups. The same week that the ADL's annual audit showed anti-Semitism at historically high levels, it was deeply disturbing and upsetting to see four temples brazenly vandalized multiple times in Riverdale, said Scott Richman, the regional director of the ADL in New York, New Jersey. "These incidents serve as a sobering reminder. We must continue to work together to stop anti-Semitism and hate from spreading in our communities. Everyone deserves to feel safe when practicing religion at houses of worship." We will have our own regional ADL director on next week, and we can discuss it. Finally, an avowed anti-Semite who wanted to kill Jews and was sentenced to death after he shot and killed three Christians at Jewish sites in suburban Kansas City back in 2014 has died in prison. Frazier Glenn Miller Jr., 80, died of natural causes at the El Dorado, Kansas Correctional Facility. He was serving a sentence for capital murder, attempted murder, assault, and firearms convictions. Miller, back in 2014, drove from his home in Aurora, Missouri, determined to kill Jews. He ambushed William Corporan, 69, and his 14-year-old grandson, Reed Underwood, at the Jewish Community Center in Overland Park, Kansas, killed them, then drove to the nearby Village Shalom Care Center and killed Terry Lamano. Two of the victims were Methodist, the other Catholic. Relatives of Corporan and his grandson said, "He stole much from our family, but he didn't steal our hearts or our dignity. He did not steal our memories, the love that sustains us, or the ability to offer forgiveness and kindness in the face of such tragedy." The Corporan family created the Faith Always Wins Foundation after the killings in an effort to promote forgiveness, kindness, faith, and healing, rather than hate and retribution. Miller, also known as Frazier Glenn Cross Jr., testified at the trial he wanted to kill Jewish people before he died. He didn't expect to live this long. He had chronic emphysema. During his trial and sentencing, if you recall, as reported on Too Jewish back then, Miller frequently interrupted the proceedings to give rambling statements about his belief that Jewish people were running the government, media, and the Federal Reserve. Miller was a Vietnam War vet who founded the Carolina Knights of the Ku Klux Klan in his native North Carolina, and later the White Patriot Party. He ran on a white power platform during campaigns for the U.S. House in 2006 and the U.S. Senate in 2010 in Missouri. Boy, some things sound familiar, don't they? And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor Idan Dershowitz, is head of Bible and its exegesis at Potsdam University, distinguished academic, although still young. He has a fascinating new book, The Valediction of Moses, a proto-biblical book. He also wrote The Dismembered Bible, Cutting and Pasting Scripture in Antiquity. What does it mean to say that the Bible was cut and pasted in antiquity?
So that is an excellent question. There have been theories among Bible scholars for quite some time that parts of the Bible were edited in a way that combines texts from different sources. And there are also some older traditional ideas that are related to this. These ideas that there might be snippets of text incorporated secondarily into various parts of the Bible, like the Song of the Ark in the Pentateuch. And what really interested me was something that Bible scholars had basically neglected, which was how, if in fact editors in antiquity combined different texts into one big composite text, say the Pentateuch, how did they actually do that? What would their desks, so to speak, have looked like? And usually scholars imagine it as a work of sort of traditional work of a scribe. A scribe would sit down with a few books, a few scrolls open in front of him, and copy some parts from here and some parts from there. But what I discovered in my research is that it seems that in several cases, actually editors would have worked by literal cut and paste, by actually cutting out snippets of text from scrolls and assembling them like a collage onto a new scroll.
It's a fascinating idea. And I know they've done some interesting DNA work recently on actual texts to show that what was the work of one hand, or where different hands were employed on what was supposed to be a unified text. Is that cutting and pasting, or were they sometimes writing their own creative, putting their own creative input into it, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you see this phenomenon in two different cases. One is when editors took pre-existing words and reassembled them with relatively few interventions. But you also see something very similar when editors were more like authors, so they were working with existing texts but writing new material and incorporating that. And I think that in both cases, editors sometimes would have used the original written text rather than rewriting the whole thing, and then they could have tacked on a new sheet at the front of a scroll or inserted something in between existing sheets or written things sometimes in the margin. There are different ways that this could be done, and in some cases I think that it also would have involved cutting and pasting.
I wonder, it seemed to me that biblical commentators were well aware of this. They called certain sections Sefer Mishpatim, for example, like it was a different book, the book of the specific human interaction rules, or Sefer Bilam. Do you think these were separate scrolls integrated at some point into the Torah itself?
I certainly think that some of these may in fact be something like that, and that's what I was alluding to earlier when I mentioned the Song of the Ark. That's another text that rabbis have suggested might have been its own independent
entity,
composition, yeah. Entity that was incorporated and then marked with these inverted nuns, or basically parentheses, to mark that it was.
So Vayehi ben Soharon Vayemer Moshe, it was a separate thing, and they're telling us with those reverse nuns that are in back, upside down nuns? I don't know. Are they backwards, upside down? It's hard to tell with a nun, isn't it?
It has the same history as the parentheses. It comes from sigma and anti-sigma in Greek scribal tradition. And yeah, exactly. That seems to be a self-conscious statement by rabbis that Torah incorporates elements that were originally their own entities.
I remember reading Ibn Ezra's commentary on Haknani Az Ba'aretz, this little passage when Abraham and Lech Lecha comes, and it says the Canaanites were then in the land. And you're thinking, well, this Canaanites were in the land for a very long time. When was this written? He understood that a long time ago. Why do you think it's become so unacceptable to talk about that aspect of the Torah among some Orthodox groups, I should say?
Yeah, I think that there has been a trend toward rejecting or ignoring these ideas that that parts of the Pentateuch were written by authors other than Moses. Although even Ibn Ezra, it should be noted, when he spoke about these ideas that parts might have been written by Joshua and so on, he was pretty elliptic and avoided saying things explicitly because he himself felt that he was saying things that were somewhat taboo.
Right.
I think that one thing that had an influence is the transformation of Maimonides' 13 articles of faith into a sort of Jewish dogma. And since that includes a statement that the Torah was given as is to Moses at Sinai, that became a real article of faith, a real tenet that couldn't be
overthrown.
Rejected.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to get to your recent work on a guy named Moshe Shapira, who was considered first a brilliant researcher and then a fraud in the 19th century when he came forward with what you think might have been an actual variant version of the Book of Deuteronomy. Can you explore that a little bit? How did you get interested in this, and why do you think what you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really, really fascinating story on so many different levels. I mean, Moshe Shapira was a really remarkable and tragic character, and in his lifetime, he had these dramatic ups and downs, and he had a nemesis who, taunted him throughout his life, and there was really a lot of drama, and the story of
it's kind of cinematic, isn't it?
it really is. It really draws you in, and that's before even getting to the most exciting part, which is the content of these manuscripts that he claimed were some ancient copy of Deuteronomy, and he was eventually and relatively quickly dismissed as a fraud himself, and everyone thought that he had forged these manuscripts himself. But my recent research, I think, has added evidence that's not the case, and that in fact he was telling the truth about about these manuscripts, which he claimed were found by Bedouins in caves near the Dead Sea, wrapped in linen and so on. This entire story would later repeat itself 70 years later with the discovery of
The Dead Sea Scrolls,
yeah, 1947. So what do you think this text was? It obviously doesn't survive. Somehow the fragments disappeared, which is the weirdest part of it, actually. But they have survived, and you've studied the drawings of them. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so unfortunately, we don't know the whereabouts of the physical manuscript, as you say, but fortunately, we do have relatively good records of what the manuscript said. So we have two known transcriptions of the text, and then I found another partial transcription prepared by Shapira himself in my recent research. And in addition to that,
by the way, that must have been a kind of eureka moment. That that's fantastic.
It's really important, not only for establishing the exact text of the manuscripts, but also for exonerating Shapira for reasons that I can elaborate upon in a moment. So in addition to these transcriptions, there are also some drawings, and using all of these things together, I was able to piece together an almost complete transcription of the text of these manuscripts, and that's enough for us to analyze the text, and in my opinion, to determine that this text is not a forgery, and is in fact an extremely ancient text, probably the most ancient biblical text ever discovered, and really the ancestor of the Book of Deuteronomy.
So the ancestor of the Book of Deuteronomy, what is it? How does it differ?
So the biggest, most fundamental difference between this text, which I call the Valediction of Moses, and Deuteronomy, is that the Valediction of Moses has no laws other than the ones that are included in the Decalogue, more commonly known as
the Ten Commandments, right?
The Book of Deuteronomy, the thing that gives Deuteronomy its name, which means the second law, Mishneh Torah, the thing that gives it its that name is this section in the book, an uninterrupted section from chapter 12 through chapter 26, which is just laws. And those laws are entirely absent in the Valediction of Moses. The Valediction of Moses also doesn't contain the poems that are at the end of the Book of Deuteronomy.
The Hazinu in that last section, yeah.
Exactly, Hazinu and Vezot HaBracha. And instead, it just has the prose and the narrative sections that deal with the events that that occurred prior to the time of Moses' speech, and also some instructions that he gives the people of Israel after they enter the land to give a blessing and curse on these two mountains, Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, and that's basically the totality of the content of the book. So most importantly, these laws that are seen as the core, the kernel, Book of Deuteronomy, are nowhere to be found, and clearly were not a part of this composition.
That's a very different book.
Indeed.
Much shorter. What do you so part of your exploration is to kind of theorize, how does this Valediction of Moses turn in later turn into Devarim, the Mishneh Torah?
Yeah, so I would say that the main thing that happens is that the law code is inserted secondarily into the Valediction of Moses, and that interrupts the narrative flow of the Valediction of Moses. In fact, and so if you read the Book of Deuteronomy, you'll find some very, very odd structural features. For example, this narrative of the blessing and curse on Mount Gerizim and Ebal, it's interrupted by the entire legal code. It begins at the beginning of Parashat Re'eh in Deuteronomy chapter 11, and then it's interrupted, and we forget that we're even talking about it because we have the entire law code, and then it picks up all of a sudden in chapter 27. And so the law was inserted secondarily, and then that required a series of additional updates to transform the book into the Book of Deuteronomy that we have today. That's it in a nutshell, although it's definitely a more complicated process.
I'm sure it's more complicated. You know, it reminds me of this section in after the death of Aaron's sons in this traumatic episode, and then it's interrupted by all kinds of chapters of law, and then we come back and find out what happened. It's like, you know, if you're going to edit this, wouldn't you do it a little, or the story of the golden calf, which is then interrupted by a bunch of other material, and then we find out kind of what happened. There's a lot of that goes on in the Torah, isn't there?
Absolutely, and usually those things are what allow us as modern readers and as Bible scholars to reconstruct the composition of a text. So when we see that something interrupts a narrative, that's often a sign that is the secondary element that was not originally there. And there are other things that we look for to support these ideas. It's not the only thing that we look at. It's definitely an important feature that helps us disentangle the various threads in the Bible.
I want to thank Professor Idan Dershowitz for a fascinating visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you and about your work?
So I have a page on academia.edu where I have most of my publications available for free download. My most recent article and book on the Valediction of Moses, I'm very pleased, are open access, so anyone can download them for free. And I encourage everyone who's interested to read these texts and to explore the Valediction of Moses itself, because I think it's a really fascinating text.
Absolutely fascinating. Idan, thank you so much, and best of luck.
Thank you.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall. In our own building, not in the mall, services, classes, and events are open to everyone once again. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. Email me to rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. Or you can join us every Friday night or Saturday morning on our Facebook page for Shabbat celebration services, Fridays at 6:30 p.m., Saturdays at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. We will continue to hold our services with full music, both in person and by virtual experience. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are now live and on Zoom. You can access those by emailing rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended formats as well. Come try it out and sign up for August when we resume. We now have students live and some on Zoom. In fact, for more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services live and on Facebook, go to beitsimchatucson.org. That's 520-276-5675, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest growing synagogue and newest Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be James Mall, director of the newly remastered release of the Academy Award-winning documentary, The Last Day, about the Hungarian Jewish community during the Holocaust. Our playout this morning comes for the upcoming Festival of Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks, when we will celebrate receiving the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai. Shavuot's a week from tonight. You are hereby invited to our Tikkun Leil Shavuot celebration at Congregation Beit Simcha for Jewish study on the subject of overcoming trauma. And, of course, we will do that by eating lots of cheesecake. And don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha this Friday night for services in Onik Shabbat or Saturday morning. Just be sure to email me to confirm, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of health and of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.